From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, President Bush presented his national energy policy. On today's Fresh Air, Christopher Flavin of the World Watch Institute calls the proposal a step backwards. And he sums up the Institute's 8th annual report on the condition of the global environment. For almost 60 years, the New Yorker magazine has lived at 25 West 43rd Street in Manhattan. Tomorrow, it's moving across the street. Humorist Calvin Trillin and cartoonist Edward Corin tell us about the ghosts and the drawings that will be left behind, not to mention the items the Smithsonian will pick up. Also, poet and novelist Dennis Johnson on life wishes as opposed to death wishes and a writer's obligations. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A spokesman for Soviet President Gorbachev said that Iraq has given a positive response to the Soviet peace plan. Vitaly Ignatenko told reporters that Iraq has agreed to withdraw its forces from Kuwait. The announcement came after more than 2 hours of discussion between Gorbachev and Aziz. Ignatenko said the discussion produced agreement on an 8-point plan. He said that Kuwait is ready for a full and unconditional withdrawal. He said the withdrawal could begin on the second day following the implementation of a ceasefire. The withdrawal would take place in a fixed period. Economic sanctions would end after 2/3 of the Iraqi troops are out. After all Iraqi troops are out, the UN resolutions would no longer be in effect. After the ceasefire begins, all POWs will be released. The withdrawal is to be conducted under UN supervision. The talks left a great number of issues to be worked out, as Ignatenko said in his conclusion to reporters.
The final outcome of this work will be made public today, on the 22nd of February, till the countries members, present members of the Security Council of the United Nations. This is what I had to say about the work conducted today. So I do think that I can say a very good morning.
Soviet spokesman Vitaly Ignatenko. Air raid sirens went off briefly in Saudi Arabia just as the announcement was being made. Reports from cable news network indicate that a Patriot anti-missile interceptor was fired and that part of the country is still under an air raid alert. Iraq fired 2 Scud missiles at north-central Saudi Arabia today, just prior to Saddam Hussein's radio address this morning. NPR's Deborah Amos was at an Allied airbase in northern Saudi Arabia at the time of the attack. She filed this report, which was reviewed by military censors.
Here at King Khalid Military City, the alarm sounded late this afternoon. It was an alarm red, meaning concern over chemical weapons. Many people here rushed to the shelters, donned their chemical weapon suits and their masks. The alarm ran for about 20 minutes. Then there was the all clear. People here were warned over announcements on loudspeakers not to pick up any of the debris from the Scud. It's unusual for this base to be targeted. Scuds usually go further south to Dahran or to the capital, Riyadh. But the tension is tightening as the ground war approaches. In northern Saudi Arabia, at King Khalid Military City, this is Deborah Amos.
The U.S. Central Command in Saudi Arabia said that the Allies have begun one of the heaviest artillery and rocket barrages of the war. The attack on targets deep inside Iraqi-held territory was described by military officials as shaping the battlefield for a possible ground offensive. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points today to close at 2,891.83. Advances led declines by 4-3. This is NPR News. The Associated Press reported today that the Bush administration is projecting that the Gulf War will cost between $58 billion and $77 billion this fiscal year. The AP quoted Defense Department documents as saying that the administration will announce tomorrow that it will ask Congress for $15 billion in taxpayer money. The report said the administration will also ask Congress for approval to use all $51 billion in aid that's been pledged so far by allied nations. Depending on the type of combat involved, the report said the government estimates the cost of the war could run as high as $44 billion through March 31st. The National Endowment for the Arts has agreed to drop a controversial requirement that grant recipients sign an anti-obscenity pledge. The pledge applied to 1990 grants only, but has remained a point of contention between the NEA and the arts community because of 2 lawsuits filed against the endowment. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The agreement to drop the anti-obscenity pledge settled the lawsuit brought by the New School for Social Research in New York. Both the New School and the Bela Lewitsky Dance Company had sued the National Endowment for the Arts, charging that the requirement to sign the anti-obscenity language attached to their grants was unconstitutional. Last month, a federal judge ruled in the Lewitsky case that the pledge was indeed an obstacle in the path of free speech rights. The NEA's decision yesterday makes it extremely unlikely that ruling will be appealed. It also clears the way for the New School for Social Research and the Lewitsky Dance Company to receive the grants they were awarded in 1990. Congress has removed the anti-obscenity language from the law currently governing the NEA, substituting instead a requirement to consider general standards of decency. I'm Ina Jaffe, reporting.
NASA officials said today that cracks have been found on the door hinges of the Space Shuttle Columbia. Similar cracks have also been found on door hinges on the Shuttle Discovery, threatening to delay its military mission next month. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush has released his National Energy Plan. The emphasis is on increasing domestic oil production and easing licensing restrictions on nuclear power plants. This strategy is not getting very good reviews from environmentalists. My guest Chris Flavin is a vice president for research with the World Watch Institute, and he's associate project director of the 1991 State of the World Report, the Institute's annual analysis on the environmental health of the planet. We invited him to discuss the state of the world, but first I wanted to hear his reaction to the Bush Energy Plan, which will soon go before Congress.
Well, the Bush energy strategy appears to be essentially a step backward into the past. It represents old priorities. It represents the mistaken assumption that we can produce our way out of our energy problems. And so far, it appears to be roundly rejected by most of the key people on Capitol Hill, including both Republicans and Democrats.
Now, the Bush policy calls for increased oil production. It makes increased domestic oil production a priority. Do you think that's a good priority?
Well, it's the wrong priority in the sense that there is not all that much additional oil to be produced in the United States. Domestic oil production peaked way back in 1972 and is now falling very, very steeply. And the idea that we can drill for oil in pristine areas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and off the coasts of California and North Carolina and significantly reduce that trend is simply a faulty assumption. The amount of oil that would be available in those kinds of areas is very small and is not going to significantly improve the country's energy situation.
Since we're over a month into a war that is in part about access to oil, were you surprised that oil conservation didn't play a greater role in the Bush energy strategy?
The Persian Gulf War clearly presents a unique opportunity for both the President and the Congress to pass the first important new energy policies in more than a decade. However, it's been fairly clear, I think, to most of us who follow this administration's work on energy fairly closely, that they were not headed in that direction. Back to the time when, you know, in the middle of the first weeks of the Gulf crisis, the President was zooming around in his speedboat off of Kenny Bunkport and saying that our way of life was at stake. I think it has become fairly clear that particularly in the White House, and I think more so in the White House than in the Department of Energy, there is simply an antagonism to energy conservation and to alternative energy development. Now, of course, it may have something to do with the fact that the President's own personal background is in the oil industry. The President's chief of staff is a nuclear engineer and a nuclear advocate by advocate. And so I think that it was fairly inevitable that once this strategy left the Department of Energy's energy professionals last December, that it would basically go the way it has, and that is that all of the good conservation measures, the alternative energy measures have been taken out, and all of the oil drilling and nuclear revival efforts have been left in.
Let's talk about what your energy policy would be if you were asked to come up with one. Can you give us an overview of what that would be like?
Well, I think the key thing is to have a guiding vision of where we need to go as a country, to recognize that we can't afford to become increasingly dependent on the Persian Gulf for oil, which is what would happen under the Bush energy strategy, that we instead need to have a plan to reduce oil imports, to at the same time reduce the overall burden that energy bills pose on our economy, and also reduce the enormous environmental burden that energy systems entail. And I think to do that, we need things like fuel economy improvement in automobiles. We should probably be aiming at doubling automobile fuel economy in the next 10 to 15 years. The technology is actually available to do that. We need to do things like make a true commitment now to rapidly developing new renewable sources of energy so that as we begin to need replacing fossil fuels in the coming decades, we will have the technologies available to do that.
That's well, but I'm wondering about how you would really get people to conserve on energy. I mean, what would you tell Americans about how to change their lifestyle, and what incentives would you give for doing it?
Well, I think one thing that we have to recognize as Americans is that we have the most underpriced energy in the world. We pay less than half as much as Europeans and Japanese do for gasoline. And I think that one thing that we're going to have to get realistic about at some point is a willingness to tax gasoline and other energy sources in a way that reflects both the national security costs and the environmental costs entailed in our very high level of energy use. Now, obviously, no one likes to pay more for anything, and tax increases are generally unpopular. But I think if we can offset those kinds of energy taxes with decreases in other kinds of taxes, such as income and Social Security taxes, we can both restore equity to the tax system if we do it in the right way, and we can also move into a kind of environment in which we begin to reduce our reliance on these dangerous fossil fuels.
Say you were able to institute an environmental tax. How would it work? What would you tax? Who would be paying?
Well, environmental taxes can encompass a wide variety of things that you would levy taxes against. But the principal ones that we have identified would be taxes on the carbon dioxide that results whenever you burn any kind of fossil fuel, that is oil, coal, or natural gas. We would also suggest levying taxes on hazardous waste, on pesticides, and on even things such as plastic packaging.
So who would be paying, the manufacturer or me when I buy my styrofoam cups? I mean, who'd be paying the tax?
Yeah, ultimately, the consumer will, of course, pay these kinds of taxes. I mean, the charge would directly be levied against the manufacturer of the product, but obviously the manufacturer will need to push that on to the consumer. I think, importantly, we have calculated that the kind of taxes, the kind of mixed environmental taxes that could be put together could raise $130 billion annually and would be enough to reduce people's income taxes by a whopping 30%. So while you may be paying a little bit more for you know, things like gasoline or various chemicals that lead to hazardous waste, you can more than make up for that in reduced income taxes, particularly if you decide to make certain choices, such as deciding to drive less or buy a more efficient car. That would, in effect, be your new form of tax deduction.
What's your opinion of the 5 cent a gallon gas tax that we already have?
Well, it's so small as to make very little difference. I think it was a very, very, you know, baby step in the right direction. I think eventually we need to go to a tax of at least a dollar per gallon, reflecting the
yipes.
Well,
that's a lot.
It's not so high when you think that in Europe gasoline taxes are as high as $2 a gallon. Now, you need to do that gradually. You don't want to put all that tax on right away. I mean, people need to have time to adjust. But you might put on, you know, say, 10 cents per gallon each year for 10 years so that everybody can gradually adjust to the change.
You know, I could see why a lot of politicians aren't getting behind this kind of tax. It's not the quickest way of getting elected, I think. I don't expect a proposal like this to have a lot of public popularity.
Well, again, I think the key is that you offset other taxes. You know, you tell people that you're going to reduce their income taxes. And if it were presented on that basis, I think the political equation would be quite different.
Chris Flavin is my guest. He's a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute, and they've just published their 1991 State of the World report, and he's an associate project director for that report. Are there other countries that have the type of environmental tax that World Watch is recommending?
Yes, environmental taxes have really begun to catch on in Europe in just the last few years. In fact, there's something of a tidal wave of adoption of environmental taxes throughout the European community. So far, for example, carbon taxes have gone into effect in Finland and the Netherlands, Norway and Sweden are scheduled to launch carbon dioxide taxes in the coming few months. Unfortunately, most of these taxes so far are essentially pilot projects. They're relatively small and are probably not going to redirect environmental trends in a big way. But I think it's an important sort of opening step. And if these efforts are successful, I would expect to see them replicated not only in Europe, but perhaps around the world.
Getting back to the George Bush energy policy, if you looked at other countries to see what kind of policies you thought we should be learning from, what would you recommend?
Well, there are a couple of interesting examples to point to. One is the country of Japan, which has had a concerted effort since the mid-70s to reduce consumption of oil everywhere in the economy that they can. And Japanese industry has really led the charge in this. They have not fought against government efforts the way U.S. industry tends to. Rather, they have put together systems where, for example, every Japanese company that uses a significant amount of energy has a special energy monitor who's quite high in the corporation. He monitors energy use on a regular basis and is continually making new recommendations for saving energy. Now, if you look to Europe, there have been some important new initiatives just in the last couple of years aimed specifically at moving those countries gradually away from fossil fuels. What the Europeans are most concerned about is the problem of climate instability, the changes in the Earth's atmosphere that are currently a result of fossil fuel combustion. And to take account of that, they are adopting new energy efficiency programs of the very sort that were deleted from this Bush energy policy.
Chris Flavin is my guest. He's senior researcher with the World Watch Institute and associate project director of their 1991 State of the World report. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Chris Flavin is my guest. He's the associate project director of the World Watch Institute's 1991 State of the World report. Let's take a look at the 1991 State of the World report. Are there any big differences from last year's pessimistic overview to this year's?
Well, I'm afraid to say that in the main areas that we monitor, that is the state of the Earth's atmosphere, the condition of the world's forests, the condition of the world's soils, in all of these areas we see a continuing decline in most parts of the world. Now, there obviously are success stories here and there, but I think overall the scale of environmental problems continues to mount at a very alarming pace, and despite the sort of new interest in the environment and the enormous new efforts on the part of many governments to get a handle on problems in the past 2 years, that most of the major environmental trends have yet to be reversed.
What about the rainforest? I thought that there was such a growing awareness about the destruction of the rainforest and that policies were starting to reverse the destruction.
Well, there is, I think, a very important, a positive development to report in terms of the condition of tropical forests, and that is the new government of Brazil. The new president of Brazil is indeed something of an environmentalist. He's appointed one of Brazil's leading environmentalists to be the Minister of Environment, and in fact, they have already removed many of the subsidies to forest burning and destruction that had existed under the previous Brazilian government. Preliminary satellite data suggests that these efforts have been at least somewhat successful. During the last dry season, the amount of burning was significantly reduced from previous years. And, of course, since the Amazon is by far and away the world's largest tropical forest, we are you know at least somewhat pleased at the trend there. I think it's too early to tell, however, whether they have got a handle on their fundamental problem, which of course is rapid population growth, enormous numbers of impoverished people that are in effect compelled to move into the Amazon, where in order to support themselves they have to destroy forest.
The Gulf War has had some terrible environmental effects. For instance, the oil spill, the black rain. I'm wondering, though, if it's brought together environmentalists from around the world, if we could see that possibly as one hopeful outcome of the world, working together of environmentalists from different countries who maybe weren't in touch before. Anything like that happening?
Well, I don't think that it's happened yet. I think that we see some inklings of that. Certainly, the efforts by King Hussein and by his science advisor to hold international conferences, and I believe that there's now a Middle Eastern Center on the Environment being set up. I believe that there are a lot of good people that would like to see, particularly in the Middle East, some sort of a regional environmental cooperation movement grow out of this. I think that would be a very encouraging sign. I do think that from a global point of view, and looking at things like a global warming and protection of tropical forests and ozone depletion and the all-important global environmental conference to be held in Brazil next June, that is in June 1992, in the case of most of these issues, I think that many of the leaders around the world are concerned that not only the obsession with the Gulf War, but the sort of new emphasis on military confrontation rather than international cooperation may take away from efforts to, in effect, put together a different kind of international order when this important governmental conference takes place next year. So we, I think, are certainly hopeful that this war is going to be over with as soon as possible, that the environmental damage is limited to what we've already seen, and that the world can get going on solving, I think, the much more fundamental problems it faces, the global environmental threats. And those are truly threats that we can only deal with in a cooperative international manner. And certainly the military, if anything, plays a detrimental role to solution of those kinds of problems.
We've been reading about black rain falling in Kuwait. Can you explain what that black rain is, what's causing it?
Black rain has been falling throughout much of the Middle East, including in fairly remote parts of Iran, as a result of the enormous fires at oil wells, at oil refineries, and a variety of other facilities in Kuwait. And what is happening is that enormous amounts of very dense black smoke is rising into the atmosphere. And then getting mixed with clouds and with other humidity in the air. And then when you end up having a rainstorm that involves the clouds that have been contaminated in that way, a lot of those particles, a lot of that dark sooty smoke actually comes down as part of the rain. Just in the same way that, for example, rains over Western Europe in the immediate aftermath of the Chernobyl accident were radioactive rains. Rain turns out to be an agent for bringing, whatever happens to be in the atmosphere at that time down into the environment and into contact with human beings and other life.
Reports are that the oil spill in the Gulf isn't nearly as large as the original estimates. Are you encouraged by that news?
Well, there have been two reports in recent days, one suggesting that the amount of oil that went into the Gulf is maybe one-tenth the size of what was originally estimated. It's not too surprising the original estimate was off. It was made principally by the military, which doesn't have much experience with this kind of thing. And oil spills, particularly if you don't have access to the place where it originates, are notoriously difficult to estimate. I should hasten to say, though, that even at one-tenth the original estimate, it is still one of the largest oil spills in world history, though not the largest, and certainly something that we should be very concerned about, particularly considering that the fact that the Gulf is an enclosed and relatively shallow body of water. It's also unfortunate to note that there have been reports out of Saudi Arabia in recent days which suggest that due to the military operations underway, due to rivalries between different ministries in Saudi Arabia, and general, you know, inexperience and mismanagement of this oil spill, the efforts to clean it up have not been at all successful to date. And so I think that those reports certainly suggest that the long-term environmental damage from this spill cannot be ruled out, even given the fact that the size may be a little smaller than was originally estimated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Flavin. He's a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute, an environmental group, and he's the associate project director of their annual State of the World Report. The 1991 State of the World Report was just issued. What are you hopeful about when you look at the state of the world?
Well, I'm hopeful about the enormous international efforts that have gotten underway in recent years to deal with global environmental problems. We have a treaty to protect the ozone layer. We're in the process of developing treaties to protect the atmosphere itself from global warming. Also, a treaty on forests is underway. I think that there is a good deal more sensitivity towards the environment on the part of both national governments and environmental agencies. And there is, I think, also in communities around the United States and around the world much more effort to do things like recycle, to try to save energy. I think that there have been a lot of benefits that have flown from the new environmental awareness that has emerged in the last couple of years. I think the challenge is that the problems themselves continue to grow at an alarming rate, and we cannot, for example, now afford to wait a couple of years before following through on the gains that we made in the late 1980s. And I think that is, in my mind, one of the major concerns about the Gulf War, the way it is distracting from these critical efforts.
You'd like to see the Gulf War used as an incentive for people to conserve energy.
I do. I think that there is a new opportunity, an opportunity that hasn't been seized by the president, but may yet be seized by the Congress, to use the fact that people are more concerned about energy than they have been for any time in 10 years to get the kinds of conservation programs going that will really make a difference. And I think that really is the challenge, not only in terms of improving the environment, but it's probably the only way to keep us out of a series of Gulf Wars in the years and decades to come.
Will you be addressing the Congress on energy policy?
I will. I'm scheduled to be testifying before a committee in the Senate, I think, about 2 weeks from now. And I believe that there are a whole series of these kinds of hearings that are now being organized. The Congress really is mobilizing on these issues.
Give us a real brief summary about what you're going to tell them.
I am going to make the essential point that we need a major turning point in national energy policy. We need to make a national commitment to get away from imported oil. We need to make a national commitment to improve our energy efficiency and to develop over the decades ahead a domestically based energy system that relies ultimately on solar and other renewable energy sources.
Well, Chris Flavin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks again, Terry.
And Chris Flavin is the Associate Project Director of the State of the World Report, 1991, published by the World Watch Institute, and he's a senior researcher at the Institute, which is an environmental group. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The New Yorker magazine is moving its offices for the first time in almost 60 years. We'll talk with staff writer Calvin Trillin and cartoonist Ed Korn about the end of an era. Stuff from their old offices will soon be in the collection of the Smithsonian. Poet and novelist Dennis Johnson keeps being pulled to real-life situations to find the truly unbelievable. Coming up, Johnson tells us what motivates him to travel to the world's trouble spots and write about them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Soviet Union says Iraq has given a positive reply to a Soviet plan for peace in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Ann Cooper says Moscow believes that the Soviet Union and Iraq have agreed on steps which could lead to an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait and a possible end to the Persian Gulf War.
Vitaly Ignatenko, the presidential spokesman, said that the Iraqi response to the Soviet peace plan was positive. And then he laid out 8 points that apparently the Soviets and the Iraqis have agreed on as a way out of the Gulf conflict. Basically, what's involved is there must be a ceasefire first, and 2 days after that ceasefire, after hostilities cease in the Gulf, then Iraq says that it will begin a full and unconditional withdrawal of its troops from Kuwait. That withdrawal is to be done within a fixed time frame. And when the withdrawal is two-thirds of the way over, economic sanctions against Iraq would cease.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. There has yet been no official reaction from the White House, although the Kremlin says President Gorbachev has telephoned President Bush with the news. The Soviet involvement in the Gulf negotiations had earlier caused some concern on Capitol Hill. NPR's Caroline Clark has more.
Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole characterizes the Soviet peace efforts as helpful, but he says he wishes they would consult with the U.S. first.
Yeah, that'd be nice if they let President Bush know before, since they're sort of an observer in all this. Nobody's being shot at, no Russians, they're not putting in any money in. All they did is let us get it through the United Nations. In my view, they're a kibitzer or an observer at most, and they ought to be contacting us every move they make.
Dole voiced concern that the Soviets have gone back to their old ways of painting U.S. actions as wrong and undertaking their own solo initiatives in foreign affairs. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The Associated Press says two of its reporters report that the all-clear siren has sounded in eastern Saudi Arabia. Other witnesses say at least one Patriot missile has been apparently fired to intercept an incoming Iraqi Scud missile. The air raid sirens went off in Saudi Arabia just as the Soviets were announcing the breakthrough on their peace plan. Officers in the Army's 1st Infantry Division say the commander of a battalion of Apache helicopters has been relieved of his post since he mistakenly fired on two American armored vehicles. Two soldiers were killed. Officers say Army Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Hales also violated division guidelines, which prevent commanding officers from personally engaging enemy forces. The two Americans were killed on Sunday. Another six were injured. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow fell 7 points to 2891.83. This is NPR. The computer maker, NCR Corporation, continues to fight AT&T's hostile takeover bid. American Telephone and Telegraph is putting up $6.12 billion in an attempt to acquire the company. NCR has now declared a special one-time-only dividend of $1 per share for stockholders and bumped its 35-cent quarterly dividend up to 37 cents per share. NASA says cracked hinges have been found on a second space shuttle door. The shuttle Columbia has now been diagnosed with the same trouble as the Discovery. Cracked hinges on the shuttle doors prevent them from closing tightly. If the doors don't close properly, the shuttle could be destroyed when it tries to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. The Discovery is set to lift off on March 9th, but NASA engineers say they don't know if they'll have the hinges repaired in time for the launch. A scandal over an interview linking the missile attacks on Israel with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has cost a German politician his job. Dieter Berger reports.
Christian Strobele, one of the leaders of the pacifist-oriented German Green Party,
says his comments were misunderstood. In an interview with the Jerusalem Post, Strobel said the Iraqi missile attacks on Israel were the logical consequence of Israeli policies towards the Palestinians. Strobel said later he did not mean to justify the attacks, which he condemns as crimes. Still, he resigned earlier today after his comments were heavily criticized by members of his own party and by the Israeli government. In another development, the Israeli ambassador to Bonn, Benjamin Navon, said the recent spate of solidarity visits by German politicians to Israel has improved the climate in Israeli-German relations. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Bergen, Frankfurt.
Reports out of Albania say the capital, Tirana, is quiet. Residents contacted by telephone say that army tanks and armored vehicles have sealed off government buildings in Tirana and that troops are patrolling the streets. Anti-government protests have been held over the last several days. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. In a column called Art and Politics, Dennis Johnson has been writing about war for Esquire magazine. Johnson is a poet and novelist who recently filed stories on Liberia and the Gulf. His fiction was described by the writer Jonathan Dee as having a disquieting ability to get inside the souls of his spiritually disoriented characters as they move along the dark edges of society. An editor at the New York Times Book Review described Johnson as one of our most inventive and unpredictable novelists. Johnson's novel The Stars at Noon is about a down-and-out American trapped in Nicaragua in 1984. Fiscadoro is about the nuclear end of the world. Farrar, Straus & Giroux has just published Johnson's new novel, The Resuscitation of a Hanged Man. I asked the poet and novelist why he's been reporting on war.
You know, I think there are a lot of levels on which to answer that question. And, the most rational one is simply that I have a belief that somebody with genuine talent for words ought to be present at places like that and kind of mediating those experiences for us. That we're obligated. Those of us who think, maybe swell-headedly that we have a talent ought to go and write about those things. But I think there's also another level which is a little murkier and harder to talk about, and that's just, maybe it's not very attractive. But I think there's just a desire to be where that kind of thing is happening and to see it. Maybe it's voyeuristic.
Well, I wonder what kind of psychological need it fulfills. I mean, there's almost like a death wish at the heart of a lot of your writing.
I don't say that. I don't buy that at all.
Oh, okay.
I think there's certainly an awareness of death, but it's not a death wish. I think there's more of a life wish in a way in wanting to be it where there's a little bit of danger and chaos. There's a feeling of being more alive, and more fully alive when that sort of thing is happening. When I was in Monrovia last fall, there was a situation where we were actually being shot at, and it was very exciting. And knowing that it wasn't going to last very long and that I would be able to go home soon made it fun almost. It made me feel as if, it was that sort of thing that Churchill talked about. There's nothing more exhilarating than being shot at to no effect.
So I guess in a way you have to be careful about this kind of journalism not becoming a self-indulgent exercise.
Exactly, yeah. And I think if I were to do much more of it, then I'd have to say that's what it would be. I'm more interested now in getting into writing about things that are not quite warlike. I'd like to write about people who are interested in UFOs and people who worship Elvis Presley, people who are weirdly religious.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe I just want to enlarge my own understanding of what it means to worship.
No, I'm wondering when you go to a place for a short period of time to write about it, if you're ever satisfied that you really understand what you're seeing.
It depends on what you're looking for. I went to Nicaragua, for example, several years ago, and I had an idea that I would write an article about it. But I'd only been there a couple of days before it was clear to me that I was never going to understand the political situation well enough to say anything worth hearing about it. And in fact, I was afraid there was a danger somebody might take me seriously. They might think I did know what I was talking about. So I ended up only writing fiction out of that visit. If it comes to trying to explain what people are about politically, going to some place for a couple of weeks is really not worth the trip. But I'm actually just interested in the sights and the sounds of places and what people have to say about themselves. And I believe I'm qualified to do that.
Your new novel, Resuscitation of a Hanged Man, is about a man who moves to Provincetown after a failed attempt at suicide by hanging. And I guess I want to start with this novel by asking you why you start there, why after the failed attempt at death.
I think the novel began with, I mean, that is my writing of it, my thinking about it, began many years ago with an actual reading about an actual historical event where a guy named Skaggs was hung in, I think, Nebraska for murder, and some doctors brought some galvanic batteries to the hanging and charged him up again, got him going a little bit. His heart was beating and so on. And this was reported in the New York Times. The guy was not actually revived, but there were some signs of life that they managed to, get going in him. And it was reported in the New York Times. I read about it in an 1870s New York Times, and it was titled Resuscitation of a Hanged Man. And I liked that title. And that was actually the image in the event, the idea that someone would be hanged and then brought back to life. That kind of got me thinking about that. And then as I started writing about this private eye and knowing that he was going to have an interest in this man, I began to sense that in his past he had done something similar. So it was not the first thing I knew about this character. First I knew that he was in Provincetown and that he had a job in a radio station and that he was a part-time private eye's assistant, and then gradually some of his history kind of came to me.
Well, you mentioned that he has a part-time job at a Provincetown radio station on Cape Cod, and for very self-indulgent reasons, I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph about what it was like for him to work at this radio station, this small provincial radio station part-time.
Okay. Essentially, on the production end of things, at WPRD, he did just what he'd been doing in the cold midnights outside Marla Baker's windows. He taped other people's conversations. But now he was right in the room with them. They saw him. He was no spy. After they went away, he edited out embarrassing slips of the tongue and overlong silences, dubbed themes and intros and outros onto either end, and tossed down the reels in the special program's in-basket. English found it all pretty dull stuff. Half-hour chats between WPRD's big yawn personalities and their baldly uninteresting guests who happened to be goofball artists, authors of books about birds and clams, or has-beens the listener would be surprised to learn were not yet dead. Sometimes English helped train new staff arrivals. These had to be frequent in order to keep up with the departures.
That's great. What made you think about this station? What made you want to write about a station like this?
Well, I did a little volunteer work at WOMR in Provincetown, and in fact, I don't think they'd be offended if I, said frankly and openly that everything that's written about the radio station in this book is, true about what WOMR was like in its very early days.
This is a very small community station, which just about everybody is a volunteer.
Yeah, it was an all-volunteer and so on, and of course, there was a lot of struggling as it got on its feet, And that's the era that I use as the model for this radio station.
And you make the comparison here, since the guy's a private investigator part-time and a radio station person part-time, that he's kind of recording conversations.
Yeah, legitimately for the radio station. And then, he thinks it's a little unethical that he does this thing without people knowing it as a private eye.
You haven't worked as a private eye, have you?
Never have, no.
Tell me what the truth infantry is.
Well, in the book, it's what it actually turns out to be is a group of Vietnam veterans who get together and talk and have target practice and just are kind of healing up and associating with one another after returning from Vietnam. But in his mind, as Leonard English, the hero of this novel, goes after the Truth Infantry to find out more about them, he believes they're a vast right-wing conspiracy that may be responsible for the death of a missing person who he's seeking. And he begins to ascribe, I think, more and more powers and, in his imagination to this group.
Does that kind of paranoid conspiracy theory tie into your interest in people who worship Elvis Presley and believe in UFOs?
Yeah, sure. I think there's a murky area where, we're not crazy, but if we think too much, things began to begin to take on a shape that's not quite discernible to the average person. And I believe there are a lot of us who just, you know, we think a lot about the death of President Kennedy or right-wing conspiracies or left-wing conspiracies, and they begin to take on sinister proportions in our minds. And the same is true, I think, if you're looking for something to worship and you have always liked, say, Elvis Presley, just as an example, it might not be long before he begins to seem some kind of a savior and have powers to influence us even after he's dead. And this is what we believe of saints as well. These are people who are spiritually blessed enough to be able to help us after they're dead, and we can pray to the saints for intercession and for miracles and so on.
My guest is poet and novelist Dennis Johnson. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Dennis Johnson is my guest. Your first book, The Incognito Lounge, was dedicated to the people I have lied to. That was your first book of poems. Your first novel, Angels, was dedicated to HP and to those who have shared their experience, strength, and hope. It sounds like you had therapy in between those two dedications.
Well, actually, no. I think the dedication was... I got off drugs and alcohol in the late 70s. And at that time, I felt kind of lonely doing that, but now it appears that there's quite a bit of that happening. The dedication to people I've lied to was written after I became chemically free, and it was, you know, written in the consciousness that I had, you know, done quite a bit of lying and, you know, wreaked quite a bit of havoc, I think, in people's personal lives, people who were connected to me. And it was something on the order of an apology, I suppose, and maybe a bit of a cop-out, too, as if I could make everything all better just by, kind of a general shotgun penance written at the beginning of a book. But anyway, it wasn't that anything had happened between those two dedications, in answer to your question.
What kind of lying would you do?
Well, just the usual kind. I mean, I think I was addicted to... Well, everything, I suppose. But it was necessary for me to do, you know, just a lot of lying in order to acquire what I needed to stay high. And then on another level, it was increasingly necessary for me to be dishonest with myself in order to keep doing something that was clearly and obviously harmful to me. And I think eventually a person gets to the point where up is down and black is white. And night is day. And that's another kind of lying. And so I'm included in that group of people I've lied to.
How did you get off drugs and alcohol?
I was in, a few detoxes and hospitals and things like that in the late 70s. And eventually in Phoenix, Arizona, I was in a place called Maverick House, which is a treatment center where they have group therapy and education and so on about addiction. I was there for 16 days, and since I got out, I've been engaged in a daily program of keeping clean and sober.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the hallucinations you experienced in the days you got high a lot affected what you wanted to get out of your writing, the intensity of it?
What do you mean by affected it?
Well, I mean, I wonder if you're going for a state of heightened intensity in your writing ever, the kind of thing that you once experienced with the help of drugs.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of what I'm aiming for, maybe what you're talking about, is just a sense that the world is very poetic as I experience it. And you can just open a door and there'll be a world of fire and chaos on the other side, and you could shut that door and open another, and you know, all the sweetness and light, and that this is a world with doors that open into other worlds. And I think that's something I experienced by, you know, messing up my head a lot in the 60s and 70s, and it's something that stayed with me, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad perception to have.
Well, Dennis Johnson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Dennis Johnson, his new novel is Resuscitation of a Hanged Man. This is Fresh Air. The New Yorker magazine is renowned for its meticulous style and standards, but its Manhattan offices, where great writers and cartoonists have worked for almost 60 years, have a different reputation, run down, shabby, and eccentric. Tomorrow, The New Yorker is moving across the street. It's the end of an era, but it's an era that seems to have already ended twice in the past few years. In 1985, the magazine was taken over by a new owner. Longtime editor William Shawn was replaced 2 years later. Cartoonist Ed Koren has worked at The New Yorker's old offices for 20 years. He draws those shaggy, snaggle-toothed beasts. The Smithsonian Institution hopes to recreate his office and the office of staff writer and humorist Calvin Trillin. We called Koren at his home in Vermont to find out what the Smithsonian plans on taking.
I was told they will take anything that I wasn't going to use, and it does pose a problem in a couple of ways, one that I have to still use all the things that are being moved. And the other is that I, you know, my particularly scuffed up desk and crummy chair, do I have to then treat them with a lot greater compassion and reverence? I know they want a calendar, and they wanted a few odds and ends on the bulletin board. They took photographs, it seems, when I wasn't there, and rather minute ones. So I guess they can reconstruct it after I'm long gone. The kind of tomb, the cartoonist's tomb.
So what are you taking with you? What do you most want to keep?
Well, in fact, I took everything with me over to the other office. It was awfully hard to unburden myself of things that I've come to live with for a long time.
So instead of making a fresh start, you want to make your new office as much as the old one as possible?
No, I think in truth, everyone at the New Yorker has a great deal of ambivalence about that very issue, whether to... I know some people are looking at this as if it were a great opportunity to rebirth themselves in a funny way, and others are simply wanting, as I do, to cling to the past, and being conservative folk, as I am, to simply... try to replicate the New Yorker as we still know it, because I think there's a lot of fear that with the new digs, there's going to be an entirely different magazine, and there's some of my colleagues feel a kind of that there's a conspiracy. They're conspiratists in general, but that the new ownership is in some ways breaking our spirit, or the spirits that have lingered for close to 60 years in those offices.
Well, what's the significance of the offices? What does it mean to people there?
Well, I've been pondering that myself. For me, it's really, I think it's partially personal, one that I've come to some sort of maturity in those offices in one way or another, or I've grown old, depending on how you look at it. They have that kind of sentimental. I have a sentimental attachment to them, even though they're perfectly inadequate when I think of the corridors and just the physical aspect of it. They're dowdy, and the lighting is bad. The scale is wrong. The surfaces, it's all monotone. They're kind of an institutional tan or yellowish tan walls with linoleum floor that is almost matches the same color as the walls. The lighting is fluorescent in large part, and it kind of deadens everything that happens to walk up and down those corridors. On the other hand, it's where a lot of ferment, a lot of talk, and a lot of personal connections is taking place.
Now, you live in Vermont.
Yeah.
When you do go to New York to go to the New Yorker offices, how much time do you spend? Do you like nearly live in your office when you're in New York?
Actually, I really do. I always feel that I shouldn't. That if I am in New York, I should be doing all sorts of other things. But in truth, I spend most of my time there.
You have a bed there and everything?
No. Although I've been known to take cat naps on the floor, but brushing aside all the dust balls and whatever has accumulated over those years. But I seem to like hanging around the office.
Do you think it will be different in the new office?
You know, I don't have any idea. And in some sense, it's a little bit of an adventure that way. I have a mixture of anticipation when I'm there this coming week. And on the other hand, I'm rather full of apprehension because I've gotten used to this quirky space of mine and all the ghosts in it. And there was a gentleman named Freddie Packard who used to inhabit my office. And somehow I feel I'm saying goodbye to him as well as all the other, you know, odds and ends of that, the rest of the office.
New Yorker cartoonist Ed Koren, New Yorker staff writer Kelvin Trillin told me one of the things he's sorry to leave behind is a drawing on his office wall by Ed Koren.
He did, I guess it was meant to be me typing, although it's needless to say, a shaggy, snaggletooth beast typing. And over him are like two angels are people handing the results in. One of them says something like, great. The other one is a rejection note that has a wonderful New Yorker phrase on it, sorry, not for us. and I'm going to be very sorry to leave that, but Ed promised me that he'd make me a new one in the new office, so it makes me feel a little better.
Kelvin Trillin, The New Yorker moves to new offices tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joseph Shabalala, leader of the South African vocal group Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Also, writer Amitav Ghosh tells us about his Egyptian friend in Baghdad. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.